The argument is surely one of those which admit of no refutation and produce no conviction. It is impossible to disprove the assertion that a direct revelation was made to us at a time of life from which no memories remain to us, but equally it is impossible to prove it. And if some other account can be given of the means by which the race or the individual arrives at the knowledge of God, surely this rather desperate hypothesis is best left in the limbo of mere conjecture. I know there is a fashion amongst modern apologists to write as if man possessed a religious sense, comparable to his sense of music. This sense, so the argument runs, is most highly developed in the saint. The mystic is the real artist, the real connoisseur. In most men it is much less developed, in some it is hardly developed at all. Not that anyone, God forbid, can be born absolutely tone-deaf to the airs of this heavenly music, but, through lack of development, the talent is nearly buried. There is no response, or practically no response, made by such a soul to the divine voice within. The spiritual man discerns spiritual things. He cannot explain to you what his experiences are, or even how he knows that they are real, any more than the musical expert can explain his emotional experiences to the mere groundling. But he knows, he has had an unmistakable experience of God's presence. It does not become us, the ignorant amateurs, to dispute his judgment. We can only trust to his higher instincts, and hope that we too, perhaps, may be privileged to hear now and again some echo of the strains that ravish him. For the life of me, I could never understand how far such authors mean their metaphor to be pressed. Is it really contended that we can argue from a state of mind to an objective reality which lies behind it? If a musical enthusiast, after listening to some rare but gay piece, should tell me that as he listened he could actually see elves and gnomes dancing before his eyes, I should be perfectly prepared to reverence both his own superior sensitiveness to musical impressions, and the subtle power of the art which could evoke such an imaginative experience. I should not suppose that elves or gnomes had been present, unseen to myself. And I confess that, if I lack the sense of religion quite so thoroughly as I lack that of music, the disclosures of the mystic would leave me in very much the same position. I might feel the mystic to be of a spiritual caliber infinitely superior to my own. I might bestow my admiration on those methods of contemplative prayer which enabled him to achieve his sense of a divine presence, his sense of union. But I should not, for that reason, be inclined to believe in the objective existence of God, his angels, or his saints, if I did not share those beliefs already. I do not know, if I'm wholly removed from the generality of mankind in holding such sentiments, but this type of argument seems to me both logically and sound and theologically perilous. And the nerve of the fallacy lies, I think, in the use of the word experience, when we are asked to let ourselves be guided by the experiences of another in matters of common human importance. We acquiesce if we do acquiesce, because the experiences in question are such as might have fallen to our lot instead of his. We have eyes, ears, and the other senses corresponding to his, and we can take the measure of his faculties from our own. If he says he saw a thing, we can relate that to our own experience of sight. If he says he heard a thing, we can relate it to our own sense of hearing. But if a man talks to us of experiences in which the faculties of outward sensation played no part, we are no longer in a position to sample those experiences for ourselves by proxy. We have no apparatus for sharing them with him. Where an experience of the outward senses is concerned, we are ready, from the analogy of our own experience, to believe that there was something there. But when the alleged experience has been apprehended through the use of spiritual faculties which we either do not possess, or do not use, our confidence in the something there necessarily evaporates. Which is, I suppose, why the Church tells us that a private revelation may be such as to demand credence from the soul which experiences it, but can never, of itself, demand credence from other people. Nevertheless, the moderns, in their desire for an easy shortcut to the proof of God's existence, are learning to rest more and more weight on this tenuous argument, as I think, fatally. In the same way, they press for more than it is worth the argument, impressive enough in itself, that, When all is said and done, most people do believe in God. Buddhism, Hinduism, paganism have at least theologies of their own. Jewry and Islamic knowledge, no less than Christendom, one God is both transcendent and omnipotent. In England itself, for all the decline of official Christianity which we were considering three chapters back, how much is there of positive atheism? Nor is the appeal to history less impressive. With the thousand strange vagaries of presentation, humanity has nearly always, nearly everywhere, attested its belief in the existence of unseen powers. Atheism nearly always, nearly everywhere, has been the reaction of a minority, a protest defying the popular instinct. Must there not, argues the apologist, be something in this popular certainty? Have we not been taught to remember that there is no smoke without fire? We can hardly account for this vast conspiracy of mankind, determined to bow down before some august power, conceived as intelligent and present to the worshipper. We can hardly account for the satisfaction of man's highest instincts through such commerce with the unseen, except on the supposition which, after all, cannot be disproved, that the God so worshipped under a thousand forms, and in a thousand manners does really exist. This contention, put in its most naked form, means that each of us ought to believe in God, because all the others do, an arrangement not differing much in principle from the economics of that famous country, whose inhabitants lived by taking in one another's washing. Once more we must insist, you cannot argue from a mere state of mind to an objective reality which that state of mind appears to presuppose. If indeed there were no way of accounting for this strange idea having got into so many people's heads, then the mere fact of its prevalence might make us suspect that there was something in it. But, as we shall see presently, it is possible to give some account of how the idea of God comes into men's minds. Or again, if each human being independently discovered the idea of God for himself, we might hesitate to ascribe the phenomenon to mere coincidence. But the doctrine of God's existence is one that is taught to childhood, one that is often bound up, superstitiously, with national hopes, with social ordinances. Even if there were no God, it is probable enough that many people would believe in his existence. It would not be more surprising than the belief in luck, for example, or the belief in omens. No, the true lesson of this widespread and obstinate theism among our fellow men is a slightly different one. The fact that so many men believe in a God ought to set us wondering whether there are not, perhaps, reasons for such a belief, to which we have not hitherto devoted sufficient attention, or perhaps reasons which we scorn to look into, because we had vaguely been given to understand that they were out of date and unfashionable. Mankind's belief in God is a rebuke to, and a condemnation of, the careless atheist. For it is the height of rashness, or of pride, to assume without investigation that so large a part of the race is giving credit to an illusion, for the existence of which no rational grounds can be assigned. In a word, the existence of religion is a challenge to us to consider eagerly whether there are not grounds for believing in God's existence, philosophical grounds which will be as cogent for us as they have been for others. When I say philosophical, I do not mean that it is the duty of the bushman or of the charcoal burner to go through a series of carefully arranged scholastic syllogisms. I mean that there exists among mankind a sort of rough, commonsense metaphysic which demands as its first postulate the existence of a divine principle in things. It can be refined, it can be reduced to terms, by the nice ratiocinations of the philosopher. It is equally valid, we hold, whether as it presents itself to the charcoal burner, or as it presents itself to the sage. The schoolman, whose method has left its stamp upon all subsequent Catholic apologetics, distinguished five avenues of approach by which we infer, from the conditions of our outward experience, the existence of a God. I, in all motion, or rather, as we should say, in all change, you can separate two elements, active and passive, that which is changed, and that which changes it. But, in our experience, the agent in such change is not self-determined, but determined in its turn by some higher agent. Can this process go on ad infinitum? No, for an infinite series of agents, none of them self-determined, would not give us the finality which thought demands, there must be, at the beginning of the series, however long, an agent is self-determined, is the ultimate agent in the whole cycle of changes that proceeds from him. Similarly, in our experience every event is determined by a cause, but that cause in its turn is itself an event determined by a cause. An infinite series of causes would give no explanation of how the causation ever began. There must therefore be an uncaused cause, which is the ultimate cause of the whole nexus of events which proceeds from it. In our experience, we find nothing which exists in its own right. Everything depends for its existence on something else. This is plain in the case of the organized individual, for plants, animals, etc., are born, live, and die. That is to say, their existence is only contingent, not necessary. It depends on conditions outside itself. Now, although the whole sum of matter does not, in our experience, increase or diminish, we cannot think of it as existing necessarily. It is just there. Its existence, then, must depend on something outside itself, something which exists necessarily, of its own right. That something we call God. In our experience, there are various degrees of natural perfection. But the existence of the good and the better implies the existence of a best, for according to Plato's system of thought, this best is itself the cause and the explanation of all good. But this best is not found in our earthly experience, therefore it must lie beyond our earthly experience, and it is this best which we call God. Everywhere in nature we observe the effects of order and system. If blind chance ruled everything, this prevalence of order would be inexplicable. It would be a stupendous coincidence. Order can only be conceived as the expression of a mind, and, though our mind appreciates the existence of order in the world, it is not our mind which has introduced it there. There must therefore exist outside our experience, a mind of which this order is the expression, and that mind we call God. It is often objected that this analysis of the facts is unnecessarily atomized. It repeats the same argument under different forms. For the purposes of the plain man, it may perhaps be admitted that the first three of these arguments are not readily distinguishable. He apprehends God in his creation, first as all-powerful and the source of all power I 2 and 3, then as all-good and the source of all goodness I've, then as all-wise and the source of all wisdom V. For all the changes that have swept over Europe since the 12th century, he has not been bullied out of his conviction. It is true, the little books of popular science which he reads in his comer of the railway train, talk as if all this process of thought were antiquated, as if something had happened in the meantime which made creation self-explanatory without the postulate of a creator. Their cocksure implications affect him like briars that flick a man across the face without turning him aside from his direction. They tell him that matter is indestructible, not elucidating their meaning, which is that man is incapable of destroying it, but even so he will not believe that matter has existed, for no particular reason, from all eternity, or that, stranger still, it brought itself into existence. They write of force with a capital F, or energy with a capital E, as if we had somehow managed to deify those conceptions, but he knows that, whereas motion is a fact that can be observed, force is a concept with which he is only acquainted through his experience as a living creature. It is a function of life, and the forces of nature as they are called, over which neither man nor beast exercises any control, must be functions of a life which is outside experience itself. They write as if science had made the problem of existence simpler by explaining the causes of things hitherto unexplained, by showing us that diseases due to the action of microbes, or the lightning, comes from the electricity in the atmosphere. But he knows that all this only puts the question a stage further back, that he is still at liberty to ask what caused the microbes, what caused the electricity. The thought of an infinite series, whether of causes or of agents, is no more attractive to him than to Saint Thomas. Of course, it is possible to avoid all these speculations with a bovine murmur of, "I don't know nothing about that," but this is to give up the riddle, and to give it up, not because you cannot find the answer, but because you have found the answer, and have found it to be unpalatable. The lines of our experience, even in the natural world outside us, converge towards one point, presuppose a creator has necessary existence, a prime mover, a first cause. But the created universe points to the existence not merely of an uncreated power, but of an uncreated mind. This argument from the order and systems to be found in creation is not synonymous with the argument from design. The argument from design, in the narrow sense, is a department or application of the main thesis. Design implies the adaptation of means to ends, and it used to be confidently urged that there was one end which the Creator clearly had in view, the preservation of species, and one plain proof of his purpose of working, namely, the nice proportion between the instincts or endowments of the various animal species and the environment in which they had to live, the warm coats of the Arctic animals, the differences of strength, speed, and cunning which enable the hunter and the hunted to live together without the extermination of either. These would be instances in point. Modern researches have given us still more salient instances of the same principle, such as the protective mimicry which renders a butterfly or a nest of eggs indistinguishable from its surroundings. Was it not a mind which had so proportioned means to ends? The argument was a dangerous one, so stated. It took no account of the animal species which have in fact become extinct. It presupposed, also, the fixity of animal types. God's mercy, doubtless, is over all his works, but we are in no position to apply teleological criticism to its exercise, and to decide on what principle the warthog has survived, while the dodo has become extinct. In this precise form, then, the argument from order has suffered badly. But the argument from order, as the schoolmen conceived it, was and is a much wider and less questionable consideration. It is not merely in the adaptation of means to ends, but in the reign of law throughout the whole field of nature, that we find evidence of a creative intelligence. By a curious trick of human vanity, we describe a newly discovered principle in nature as so Ansoff's law, Doyle's, or Newton's, or Tyndall's, as if the discoverer were himself the legislator. I'm not grudging honor to the pioneers of research, I'm only commenting on an oddity of phrase. Surely, when a thing is unexpectedly found, we congratulate the person has found it, but our next question is inevitably, who put it there? And, if there are laws in nature to be discovered, it is but natural to ask the same question, who put them there? If it needs a mind to discover them, did it not need a mind to devise them? If the whole of our experience is not a phantasmagoria of unrelated facts, if water does not flow uphill, and gases do not double in volume when the pressure on them is doubled, was it willed that the thing should be so? Not we assuredly, not Boyle, not Newton, not blind chance, for there is a limit to coincidence. Not nature, for there is no such person, she is only an abstraction. What hypothesis is left to us, except that of an ordering mind? Instinctively we speak of a law, when we find a natural principle, and have we no right to argue from a law to a legislator? I know that to superior persons all this will sound very naive, but it is easy to suspect simplicity in your opponent's mind, when the simplicity really lies in the facts. There are thoughts so obvious, that we are apt not to reflect upon them, so familiar that we are in danger of forgetting them. So far we have been dealing with the evidences for God's existence which are concerned with outward nature, not with the inner life of man. The argument from perfection adduced by the schoolmen is not the modern argument from moral perfection. The plain man would probably conceive the relations between God and man in the moral sphere with more of directness, more of concreteness. He would tell us that the voice of conscience was a voice not his own. Whose then can it be, if it be not divine? Or he would tell us, in Kant's vein, that the sense of moral duty is the sense of an obligation imposed upon us by a sovereignty outside ourselves, whose sovereignty, if not God's. Or he would tell us, that the sense of compunction which he feels, when he has done wrong, is not to be explained away as mere disappointment with himself. It carries with it the sense, that he has defied a power above himself, whose power, If it be not God's, to each his own appeal, there is little need to dwell on this side of the argument, for probably everyone has the least hankerings after theism, feels the force of it in one form or another. Otherwise I would ask space to argue that the scholastic form of it has a special value, as the truest both to the philosophic and to the devotional instinct. I have made no attempt in this chapter to deal with the objections which will present themselves to minds influenced by the more intimate doubts of idealism. I have been forced to assume what the schoolmen assumed, and most ordinary people assume, that our thought is an instrument adequate to the cognition of objective reality. Still less have I attempted to anticipate the rejoiners of the pragmatist who, it seems to me, above all men should wish to be a Catholic, and above all men, will find it difficult to become one. I have merely indicated the course which Catholic apologetic takes in this fundamental matter, trusting that the inquirer, if his doubts begin so early in the process, will find access to more lucid and more copious expositions than mine. 5. The Catholic notion of God. If the arguments adduced in the foregoing chapter are valid, they commit us not only to a belief in the existence of God, but to certain views as to his nature. I do not mean to discuss, or even enumerate here, as a textbook of theology would, the various attributes of God, for fear of unduly crowding the canvas. It is enough for our present purposes to insist that the God as postulated by a consideration of his works in nature must be a transcendent God, an omnipotent God, and a personal God. The very nerve of our contention is that the material world which meets us in our experience does not provide the explanation of its own existence, or of the forces which control it, or of the laws which govern it, that the explanation, consequently, must be looked for in something that is outside and beyond itself. Our thought can only be satisfied by the existence of some necessary being, to which all this contingent existence around us, the world of creation, is secondary, and upon which it depends. Upon which, or rather, upon whom. We must always explain the lower in terms of the higher, not the higher in terms of the lower. And the highest form of existence, of which we have any experience, is spirit. Man finds himself possessed of this apparently unique privilege, that he can become the object of his own thought. He can focus his attention, not merely upon things outside himself, but upon himself the thinker, upon himself thinking. Adam must have had many strange experiences when he woke in paradise, but none stranger than that of meeting himself. The difference between this self-consciousness and mere consciousness is as real, as vital, as the difference between consciousness itself and mere life, or the difference between life and mere existence. This spiritual principle, this self-conscious life within man, is not accounted for, still less explained, by his needs as a mere citizen of the natural creation. It is something altogether outside the scheme of ordinary organic life. It exists for its own sake, and must therefore be regarded as a higher order of existence. It is to this higher order of existence, naturally, that he refers that highest of all possible existences which he calls by the name of God. It has been a favorite taunt of the unbeliever, from Xenophanes down to Rupert Brooke, that if horses had conceived of theology, they would have imagined God like themselves. If fishes had invented a theology, they would have imagined God like themselves. The criticism is one of those which miss the mark so completely as to provide their own refutation. For the fact is, that man is superior to horses and fishes in one point, namely, his self-consciousness, his spiritual life, and it is precisely in virtue of that spiritual quality, and of that alone, that he has dared to conceive of God as like to himself. He conceives of God, not as a big man, but as a great spirit, lacking precisely those features of inferiority which link man, in his dual nature, to the brutes. Man's soul, which in memory, in intellect, and in will stands outside of, and superior to the accidents of his mortality, is the only mirror he finds in nature of that pure act, that tireless energy which is God. And if God be spirit, then he is a personal God. For all our experience of spirit, all our evidence for its existence, rests upon the first-hand consciousness which each man has of himself, and second-hand indications which point to the existence of a similar consciousness in his neighbor. Each spirit, as it is given to us in our experience, is a lonely point of conscious existence. Matter, as we know it, may enter into various combinations, and assume various forms. We do not meet with spirit, we only meet with spirits. And the notion that God is not a spirit, but the totality of existing spirits and nothing more, the notion that he is spirit, and not a spirit, is pure mythology. It overlooks that individuality, that incommunicableness, which belongs to all spirits in our experience. It is not suggested, of course, that the being created us is subject to all the limitations which our minds may happen to associate with the word personality, but in thinking of God as a spirit, we cannot rule out the idea of conscious individuality, for that idea is essential to our whole conception of a spiritual nature. We must not conceal from ourselves the fact that in so defining the nature of God as transcendent, omnipotent, and personal, we have parted company with a great number of the more religiously affected of mankind. We have said nothing, so far, which could not be echoed by a Jew, or by a Mohammedan. But we have quarreled, already, with that pantheistic conception of the divine being which has had such a profound influence on other religions of the East. The vice of pantheism is that its theology takes life, not spirit, as its point of departure. To chatamizing the world wrongly, into matter and life, the pantheist assumes that the animal organism is the mirror of the universe. As, in the animal, matter finds a principle of life to organize it, so the whole sum of matter in existence must have a life to organize it, a life which is the summing up of all the life, vegetable or animal, which exists. This life is God. God is to the world what the soul in the widest sense is to the body. Thus, on the one hand, the pantheist theology contrives to give an explanation of existence which is no explanation at all, for the totality of our experience plus a world soul does not, by reason of the addition, provide any account of how or why it came into existence. And on the other hand, it encumbers our thought with the concept of a God as no God, is, indeed, but an abstraction, as animal life divorced from matter is an abstraction, can neither affect our destinies, nor prescribe our conduct, nor claim our worship, impotent, unmoral, and only demanding by courtesy the typographical complement of a capital G. So sharply is the God whom we Catholics worship, we Catholics, with the Jews and the Mohammedans divided from the notion of deity which has syncretized, spiritualized, or superseded the many-headed monsters of the pagan East. Is the God of modern Protestantism so clearly marked off from his Oriental counterpart? I confess that I entertain acute and growing misgivings on this point. The tendency of Protestantism, as I suggested in the last chapter, is to find its evidence of God's existence rather in some supposed instinct or intuition than in any inference from premises grounded in experience. But such methods of proof, even granted their validity, would only warrant us in accepting the fact of his existence, without telling us anything about his nature. Most men believe in God, yes, but then a very large percentage of them are pantheists of one shade or another. The common belief of mankind does not, then, proclaim the existence of a deity as transcendent. There is in man's nature an itch for worship, an instinct for religion, yes, but what sort of religion? Why should not Buddhism, for example, satisfy the craving? Mystics have had direct experience of God's presence. It behoves us, then, to trust their experience, rather than our own earthbound imaginations, yes. But which mystics? The Christian or the Buddhist mystics? Unless we are prepared to fall back on the doctrine of Descartes and Berkeley, would make God immediately responsible for those ideas through which alone we come in contact with any outside reality. It seems to me that all direct proofs of God's existence yield only a blank formula, which we have no intellectual apparatus for filling in. What kind of God, then, does Protestantism mean to propose for our worship? Our idealist philosophers, still mournfully chewing the cud of Hegelianism, have no assurance to offer, either that God is omnipotent, or in what sense he is personal. There remains only the moral argument, to distinguish Protestantism in its more adventurous forms from the cruder forms of pantheism. Doubtless it will always be held, at least in the Western Hemisphere, that the Supreme Being, however conceived, must be the summing up of all those aspirations towards goodness, which our own moral experience teaches us to indulge, but is such a God necessarily the judge of living and dead?